from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, there are more than 100 cases of the novel coronavirus in the U.S. and 9 deaths. And while the epidemic is easing in China, it continues to grow in parts of Europe and the Middle East. It's having far-reaching effects on markets and countries. The Federal Reserve yesterday cut interest rates as investors remain jittery. Political scientist and Eurasia Group founder Ian Bremmer warns that the epidemic is
by far the most important global crisis of the Trump administration, but frankly the largest that we've experienced since the 2008 financial crisis.
Ian Bremmer joins us in studio to discuss the impact of the outbreak and what may be in store, and that's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The World Bank announced yesterday it would commit $12 billion in loans, grants, and technical assistance for developing countries to help fight the new coronavirus. The virus, which has spread to at least 70 countries, is creating an economic slowdown that some fear could tip the world into recession. And joining us now to discuss the economic and political impact of the outbreak is Time Foreign Affairs columnist and president of the Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer. Welcome back to Forum.
Good to be back with you.
Pleased to have you. And we ought to mention, by the way, that not only is Ian Bremmer a columnist and editor at large at Time, whom I read religiously, but he's also and president of the Eurasia Group, but and G-Zero Media. He's also host of G-Zero World with Ian Bremmer, which you can hear Thursdays at midnight right here on KQED+. Well, I want lots of things to talk with you about. In fact, I thought we could do kind of a global survey. We've been, because of all the election news and everything that's going on with coronavirus and neglecting things that are going on in the world. But let's talk first about the global economy. I mean, like I say, I've been reading you and you've been talking about the possibility of the coronavirus opening up, upending the global economy. And this is a real danger now. I mean, it's in many people's minds almost imminent.
This is the first global crisis we've had since 2008. And the difference is that the politics of the response are so much more divisive now, both inside the United States as well as globally. Right? You remember in 2008, there was both the Bush and the Obama administrations came together to support bailouts in the financial industry, also in Detroit. The world came together, the G7, the G20, in saying we need coordinated stimulus and we need to work to improve consumer sentiment. Those things are not happening right now. That creates a lot more panic, right? And so I think that irrespective of how bad coronavirus becomes, and we can talk about what's happening in China and the implications more broadly for developed and emerging markets, but certainly the resilience to respond to a global crisis is not what we would like it to be. And I think that's part of the reason the markets have been as volatile and as negative here in the United States over the last 2 weeks.
Well, developing and emerging markets have certainly been fluctuating all along, but the Chinese supply chain has been shut down as a result of this. And you pointed out that this is really this began in phase one with the trade deal, I think, as you also pointed out. But this is really something that could bring terrible economic slowdown. It's already happening to some degree. And fear of recession is palpable.
I think the really big thing that's happening here is that globalization is changing in trajectory. And that started well before coronavirus. That started in the technology space. We're going after Huawei and other Chinese tech companies, 5G, artificial intelligence. The Chinese are doing everything possible to have control of their own supply chain. So a decoupling of the world's two largest economies in the most advanced sectors of those economies, where the Americans are telling our allies they'll be hell to pay if you don't link up with us, and the Chinese are spending lots of money through Belt and Road saying, no, you guys need to align with Beijing. So that's where it really started. And then you have a lot of companies that have been recognizing that they didn't need as much labor to make their business work over the past 5 years. and the costs of Chinese labor were going up. The competitive environment was more challenging. Rule of law was not being developed. Then you have coronavirus, where suddenly you don't have good data, your expats are scared, and your supply chain has been disrupted. Well, we're not now just talking about AI and technology. We're now talking about services and manufacturing, where a lot of Western companies are going to look at China and say, we really don't want to have that level of global exposure that we did before. So the big point here is that over the last 50 years, so much of what's been good about the global economy, creating a global middle class, improvements in life expectancy, improvements in education and health, they've come from goods and services and data moving across borders faster and faster and faster. Well, now what we're seeing is there's a tremendous backlash against that in some core components of the global economy. And obviously, that's going to have very long-lasting implications for all of us here in the United States.
It's kind of scary.
It's not great. I mean, the positive side is that our own political institutions in the wealthy countries, the U.S., Europe, Japan, are actually quite resilient for different reasons. So it's not as if we're facing the end of representative democracy or that we're no longer going to have checks and balances, irrespective of what you think about the present administration. But certainly the quality of global growth and the volatility around our economic returns, those things are going to change pretty dramatically. And coronavirus is absolutely a big piece of that.
I'm talking with Ian Bremmer, and he's also the author of a book called Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism. You're a fan, you've said, of globalization, but not of globalism. Distinguish those for us.
Well, that's right. And we're kind of talking about it, right, in the sense that globalization is simply the fact that if you have more open borders, you will have more efficient global growth, that you want to be able to take advantage of global capital and human capital to ensure that companies are as profitable as possible. You don't want five sets of standards. You want one set of standards and rules and norms. But globalism is the idea that promoting policies of free trade and open migration and the promotion of democracy and free market capitalism, that those things will automatically lead to better lives for everyone. And what we have, of course, seen is that actually inequality in our own country and in democracies around the world has expanded dramatically. And so that's why you get Trump. It's why you get Sanders. It's why you get Brexit. It's why you get the Gilets Jaunes in France. It's why you get the Five Star Movement and the League in Italy, and on and on and on. In fact, the only major advanced economy that doesn't have this response is Japan. And the reason for that is because their population is shrinking. So even though the economy is flat per capita, they're doing better. There's no immigration, so they're not opposed to all these people coming in that are different. And they don't fight any wars, so they're not angry about the promotion of democracy internationally that their poor people have been paying for. They're not doing it. But the Japanese model is not a model the Americans are about to emulate. So globalism has actually been a failure in this country and in many countries around the world. And it's very hard for someone like me who likes globalization to tell fellow Americans, oh, you should support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Oh, you should support more open borders, when we know that we're not taking care of those people. I'm deeply empathetic to the idea that they would stop supporting globalization because they're not benefiting from it.
I was just thinking, though, when you say Japanese aren't fighting any wars, there's certainly a lot of tension with China over territory, and there's even more tension, one could argue, with North Korea. No wars notwithstanding. I want to get
our security umbrella providing support, and one of the reasons why they are right now the single largest foreign holders of American debt.
Let me ask you about what I mentioned at the top, that yesterday the World Bank decided to give $12 billion in loans and grants to developing nations, technical assistance as well, to do something about the coronavirus. What kind of a dent, what kind of an impact do you see with this?
It's a little short. It's a little late. But everything matters. The emerging markets are in deep trouble here. The South Koreans and Japanese are passing supplementary budgets and they're doing fiscal expansion. The Germans and the Europeans are supporting same for Italy, despite the fact that it'll run up against their debt limits that for the European Union rules. In the United States, Trump hasn't asked for much, but Congress is passing significant emergency aid. If you look at countries like Argentina, right, Venezuela, Turkey, major emerging markets around the world, they do not have the fiscal space. And the danger is that those governments will turn in a much more populist, nationalist direction that will have much farther reaching and long range consequences, hurting their own population. So it's certainly good that the World Bank is doing that. I was happy to see the United States willing to provide some humanitarian support for Iran, who's yeah. Truly, I mean, their economy was imploding on the back of the sanctions from the U.S., but they've had clearly the worst outbreak of coronavirus impacting their society and government of any country in the world, including China, in my view, and they have no capacity to respond to it.
Let me ask you what your thoughts are on the Federal Reserve Board cutting interest rates. I mean, how is that going to affect the whole global picture or affect us here domestically?
Well, let's keep in mind that in 2008, before the financial crisis, the Fed rate was 5.25%. So there was a lot of room, a lot of ammunition we could use to reduce interest rates and juice the economy short term, which, of course, we did. Before the emergency drop in the Fed rate that we saw on Monday. And let's keep in mind that that's the first time we've had an emergency drop since 2008. The Fed rate was just over 1.5, and 75 basis points, so 0.75% of further reduction was already priced into the markets. All of the banks recognize that. So the 50 basis point reduction had no impact on the markets whatsoever. It didn't make a dent. In fact, you'll remember the markets were down about 3% that day, in part on that, and in part on the G7 coming together, the world's largest advanced industrial democracies, and not even having a communique on how they were together going to fight and respond to coronavirus. So it's that lack of political resolve and coordination that I think is concerning markets because, as you know, you talk about globalization. One thing I assure you that's very globalized is coronavirus. Doesn't respect borders, isn't nationalist or populist. We're all just people, according to coronavirus. And you would, just like climate change, if you want to respond to that, you really need a global response. But our politics are anything but global today, and that is causing a lot more friction.
We're talking with Ian Bremmer. He's president of the Eurasia Group. And if you have questions for him or if you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And I said at the top that I wanted to do a little survey with Ian Bremmer because he's so on top of global affairs. And let's talk about a couple of peace pacts. I haven't had an opportunity, like I said, with all the news with the election and so forth to talk about these. But there was a deal that was hammered out 4 days ago with the Taliban between the United States. And now, 4 days later, we've got U.S. forces striking the Taliban to halt their actions against Afghan forces. I mean, what's happening to this deal that was eked out?
Well, the deal was not done with the Afghan government. The deal was done with the Taliban. And the reason for the deal is because the United States has been fighting this war for 19 years. It's the longest war in American history.
And the president would like to bring the troops home.
Yes. It's obviously there's no military win coming in the foreseeable future. There's no strategy for one. And the average American has gotten tired of spending the money, of taking the casualties, and of continuing these sorts of fights. And this isn't just Afghanistan. This is Syria. This is Libya. I mean, there are a bunch of places around the world where the Americans are increasingly saying, not our fight. And I do believe that Trump, I mean, even as you've seen Taliban attacks in Afghanistan, so the reduction of violence not really holding, and the agreement was only for a 7-day, not ceasefire, but reduction in violence. Trump is still saying, I had good conversations with the Taliban. You saw Secretary Mike Pompeo shaking hands with the lead negotiator from the Taliban, who's seen as a terrorist by many. And Trump's view is this is a positive. And his view is it's a positive because the Americans are now going to significantly reduce the 14,000-some troops we have on the ground in Afghanistan. And if all continues as planned, by next April, the U.S. will no longer have any boots on the ground in that country. Now, again, it's a lot easier to negotiate a deal when you're only negotiating with one side. The Afghan government and the Taliban have not engaged in negotiations. Part of the agreement was by the end of March, 5,000 Taliban prisoners are supposed to be released by the Afghanis, and 1,000 Afghan fighters are supposed to be reduced by the Taliban.
Makes the Afghan government incensed, I'm sure.
Of course. But at the same time, they don't have any cards here because the Taliban has been winning. The Afghan government doesn't control a lot of the country. And that's why the Taliban is part of this deal. You don't see any disarmament. They're not setting aside their rifles and their RPGs. So, I mean, the likely outcome is a little bit like the likely outcome in Syria, which is ongoing fighting, and the bad guys ultimately win. Remember, Obama said that Assad must go. Assad didn't go anywhere. We've been fighting against the Taliban for a long time. But ultimately, American interests in Afghanistan are vastly less than those that are fighting on the ground.
Well, Obama also said that we had to be in Afghanistan to protect against al-Qaeda coming back and establishing a base there. And what's to keep the Taliban from moving in that direction if we move all our troops out? I mean, this is certainly a grave concern to many people, understandably.
Yes, it's less of a grave concern to Americans, and that's part of the point. I mean, you'll remember, I'm going to answer your question with a bit of a deflection, when the Americans were trying to pull troops out of Syria, and did pull a couple hundred back from the border with Turkey, there were many Kurds allied nominally with the United States who were fighting against ISIS on the ground. And there were about several thousand prisoners, many of whom had been active ISIS fighters, that were being kept in jails guarded by the Kurds. So the question was to Trump, well, if you pull out, what's going to happen when all of these ISIS fighters escape? And Trump said, well, if that happens, it's mostly going to be Europe's problem. Now, to be fair, I wish he hadn't said that because there are allies and you don't want to undermine longstanding alliances by showing that you don't care and you're transactional. But I also want to say that Trump's point was analytically true. That, I mean, the dangers that are coming from all of this instability in the Middle East and in Afghanistan are vastly more problematic to those who are geographically proximate than they are to the United States. And further, the largest energy producers in the world right now are the Americans. So OPEC just isn't as relevant as it used to be, and acting as the policeman in this region of the world isn't as relevant as it used to be. And one of the reasons that Obama and Trump have been pushing the Europeans with only marginal success to dramatically ramp up their military spending is in recognition of that changing reality. I don't think that's going to change after Trump is no longer president, whether that's in the coming year or in five.
As long as we're talking about peace plans, I wanted to get your take on the Middle East peace plan that's been put forward by the Trump administration, which I believe you've said in print is worth assessing. And yet the fact is, well, aside from the fact that Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu have backed it and it's getting backed by the administration, seems to be that the Palestinians simply don't want to even have a look at this or don't want to even consider it. And there's been a lot of concern that it's much more to Israel's benefit than it is fair or equitable with the Palestinians. So what's worth assessing here?
Well, it's very similar to the Afghan deal. I mean, the reality is it's much easier to come to an agreement when you only negotiate with one side. And the Americans did not negotiate with the Palestinians. They negotiated with the Israelis. I mean, Jared told me directly, Jared Kushner, who was, you know, the architect of the plan, said, look at this map. And this is the first time that we've actually directly articulated a final status map for the Israelis and the Palestinians. And my response to him was, well, sure, like if I were only talking to the Israelis, I could have come up with a map too. But what's interesting here is a recognition, very similar to Afghanistan, that the status of forces, the power balance in the region has changed. And if you go and talk to the Gulf Arabs or the Egyptians or the Jordanians and you ask them what their priorities are in the region, Israel-Palestine isn't even in the top five. It's ISIS, it's Al-Qaeda, it's Syria, it's Iran, right? It's domestic stability, it's all of these questions. And so the Palestinians today, with the U.S. peace plan, the Palestinians get about 70% of the territory in the West Bank, compared to well over 90% back in the Clinton days. And then they also get some additional territory in the Negev Desert, which is not contiguous, that would bring them up to about 86% of their previous territory. Part of the reason is they've lost wars. Part of the reason is the Israelis no longer need to negotiate with the Palestinians. It's not a national security crisis for them anymore. They don't need Palestinian labor. They've got Iron Dome stopping the missiles from coming in. They've got sensors underneath the wall stopping the tunnels from coming through. I mean, the Palestinians are no longer a proximate existential threat to the Israelis. And so for all the people out there like Tom Friedman, who have been writing for decades that time is on Palestine's side, that if the Israelis don't come to a deal, that it'll be the end of Israel, that was really bad advice. The Palestinians will never get a deal like they were offered before, and their governance has been bad, and they're increasingly isolated by both their friends and their enemies around the world. So, you know, it's a depressing thing because, of course, the outcome for the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, where unemployment is 50%, I mean, these are people, and they're people with no future. They're people who have so given up that they're throwing themselves at defended border with Israel, where the Israeli Defense Forces have orders to shoot and use lethal force for those that try to breach it. And yet they're doing it just to show that they still have voice, that they still have humanity. It's deeply depressing.
This is a deal. I didn't know you were on a first-name basis with Jared Kushner. This is a deal that he pretty much, as you say, was the architect of, that tries to provide sovereignty, at least on the face of it, for the Palestinians with essentially a capital in East Jerusalem or near East Jerusalem.
Near East Jerusalem, the outskirts. Yeah, and with lots of money that would be coming from the U.S. and from Arab states to support investment into the Palestinian territories and some for integration of Palestinian migrants in Jordan, in Egypt, if the deal was accepted.
But Abbas is saying no deal.
No, I mean, of course not. Again, a complete non-starter for the Palestinians.
We're talking with Ian Bremmer, and we're going to invite you again to join us on this program if you have questions or comments. Talking about a lot of things, the economy, the effect of coronavirus on the economy, what's happening around the world, and particularly a couple of peace agreements. If you'd like to add your voice, we want to hear from you. Questions for Ian Bremmer, you can give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or you can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. And again, Ian Bremmer is foreign affairs columnist and editor-at-large, Time Magazine, president of the Eurasia Group and G-Zero Media, and the host of G-Zero World with Ian Bremmer, which airs Thursdays at midnight on KQED Plus. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Ian Bremmer. We're talking about geopolitical and economic repercussions of coronavirus, also talking about a couple of agreements that were hammered out that don't seem to be going very far. One is between Israel and the United States, the Palestinians, actually, as Ian Bremmer said, it was pretty much all intake from Israel, and also an agreement that was put forward by the Taliban in the United States, which the Afghan government didn't have much involved in. Here's Bradley, who writes, last night Ian Bremmer compared the results between Biden and Bernie and noted that while Biden's success is stunning, Bernie's positions make it clear that there can be no going back to the happy days of Obama. Biden, take note, Latinos and young Americans cannot be ignored because they are now at the forefront of our politics. This is what you are on record saying?
Well, I mean, some of that. I also said that part of the issue that Bernie has is that young people are very engaged in politics, but they don't vote. And we saw that yesterday in Super Tuesday results as well. That's also why Brexit happened. Young people didn't vote. So, I mean, Bernie clearly has shown that he has a lot of enthusiasm across the country, and he's drawing really big crowds for a lot of his demonstrations and a lot of his rallies. But he seems to have a pretty hard cap at about 30% in a lot of these places, and that ain't going to get you the nomination.
Tweet from Farzam. How does coronavirus change the argument surrounding a national health care plan? I've heard it costs $3,000 to $4,000 to get tested for those who are uninsured.
Yeah, I do think that the reality of how poorly the Trump administration is being seen as responding to coronavirus in the first few weeks, aside from the positive steps they took to have travel restrictions, particularly vis-a-vis China, but on the ground in the U.S., certainly not having tests and not having tests available, I think you're going to see some kind of federal response an emergency response that will provide funding.
You think it's hurting Trump politically?
I mean, no question.
With Mike Pence in charge of all people?
It's not so much that Mike Pence is in charge. I mean, if you saw the press conference he gave the other day, he let the experts do most of the talking. I think it would have been much worse for Trump if he had said, I'm in charge here. I know everything. I mean, just handing it off away from him personally, I think it does create a greater sense of normalcy. But the reality is that we don't have the resilience. We don't have the test kits. We don't have the stockpiled medical equipment or the pharmacological agents that we need. Some of that has been lack of stockpiling. Some of that is the supply chain comes from China and it's been disrupted. The U.S. is going to have to act in a very coordinated way very quickly to avoid serious panic buying. So far, the record that the Trump administration has had has been very poor on that.
There's also a lot of concern about drugs coming from China because so many ingredients go into those drugs.
That's right.
In China.
That's right.
Let me, by the way, tell the listeners, since we just touched on politics domestically, if you're looking for all the results from the local ballot, we have them. KQED has the latest updated results for all local races at kqed.org/elections. And let me go to your calls. And let's begin with Matt. Matt, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, hey, I just wanted to ask Ian, of course he travels the world. I mean, is there anyone that takes Donald Trump seriously anywhere in the world at this point? Seriously, I mean, we all pretend that, I mean, obviously he's still the president of the United States. We get that. But, I mean...
Actually, Matt, if you read Ian, you will learn that Modi in India seems to take Trump very seriously. I mean, Trump does have his allies, particularly, it would appear, among many of the autocrats, and I would include Putin in that.
Well, there's a difference between whether individually leaders think he's smart and capable. And I would say, you know, generally the response to that is not particularly. Then you have, is he actually liked and aligned with any leaders around the world? The answer to that is clearly yes. Netanyahu and Gantz in Israel, which is why they both came to support that deal, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Indians, the Brazilians, Bolsonaro. You know, so you have a bunch of countries that both ideologically and strategically are aligned with Trump. Then you have other countries that just desperately rely on the United States. And no matter who the president is, if the president says jump, they're going to jump. So Lopez Obrador, who before he became president of Mexico, the only places he had traveled to in the world were Cuba and Venezuela. I mean, he's more likely to be a Bernie Sanders supporter than Donald Trump. But he did everything he could to get the new NAFTA, the USMCA deal together. And when Trump said, I'm going to hit you with tariffs if you don't close the border to illegal immigrants, he did it. He found the resources and he actually stepped up the border. Trudeau, Canada, same story. Abe, Japan, given the importance of the U.S. security umbrella, same story. So, you know, we also need to recognize that the reality of being president of the United States, by far the world's most powerful country, yes, even given the economic and technological technological rise of China does mean that you've got a lot of influence. And again, not to say that Trump doesn't have his serious challenges and unfitness for office in terms of who he is, but that shouldn't take away from the reality analytically of what the guy can do and what the guy has done.
Well, here's a perfect question apropos of that, and you can also decline to answer this, but Jenny asks, which candidate for U.S. president has the most reasonable and most likely beneficial philosophy about foreign policy for the near future?
Well, first of all, that's a lot easier question to answer now because most of them have dropped. In the case of Bernie versus Biden, I mean, Biden has vastly more foreign policy experience than anyone else out there.
Tom Friedman, when he was proposing that idea of, you know, a mixed cabinet, when there were so many candidates, said Biden should be Secretary of State.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that is that Biden has still a worldview that hasn't changed much in the last 20 years. But the world has changed dramatically, both in terms of the rise of China and the inability of the Americans to push back on a lot of the competing architecture like Belt and Road that the Chinese are developing, the weakness and fragmentation of Europe, the willingness of the Russians to undermine us to a much greater degree than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So I do worry that Biden would really need an infusion of a lot of different thinking folks to be effective in foreign policy if he wins the presidency. In the case of Bernie Sanders, he has literally no experience in foreign policy, and we don't know what his team would look like. So that remains an open question at this point. And Trump, I would say some of his instincts in foreign policy actually do reflect where the world has been heading, but his capacity to execute is deeply, deeply limited. His personnel, his bench has not been strong, and he hasn't been willing to rely on the bench he has very consistently. And so clearly the foreign policy score that Trump has had, he's had some successes, but on balance, American influence around the world has deteriorated rather more quickly under Trump than it had under Obama. And Trump is somewhat responsible for that.
And we go to Maria Calls. Bob, or Rob, excuse me, you're on. Good morning.
Thank you. Pleasure to speak to you, Mr. Bremer. I've always appreciated your big picture view of the world. I was going to talk about Trump's messing up the situation with China. Not so much that he challenged them finally, because I think we've gone soft on them and allowed them to cheat at so many of the international rules for just way too long. But I just don't think that the way he's gone about it has been beneficial to the United States or the world. But wondering, number one, what he thought about that. And number two, what does he think about if Trump is not reelected and the new president comes in, can the new president build on what Trump has started in this pushback against China and actually make it more constructive for both company or for both countries?
You could be much more constructive vis-a-vis China, because what you need, of course, is a more multilateral approach. The fact that Trump, jettisoned the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a strategic mistake, in my view, because it was going to give you an agreement that aligned the United States more deeply with allies not only in Asia but also across the Western Hemisphere, that really provides carrots and sticks to nudge the Chinese in a more constructive direction on a whole host of trade and IP and rule-taking measures going forward. So that was unfortunate. And Trump also doesn't have alignment from the Europeans on things like technology. Now, some of that is because his relationship with those leaders is bad. Some of it is because they don't trust the Americans. You saw Snowden, and you saw the Americans surveilling Angela Merkel's private cell phone. Now, that didn't happen under Trump. But that hasn't been fixed, right? So, I mean, the fact that you now have the Europeans who are saying, well, Chinese tech is cheaper, we're already using a lot of it, and we don't really trust the Americans, so why don't we still work with the Chinese? I mean, that's a deep, deep problem in the most important security relationship in the world, the transatlantic relationship. It's kind of almost an existential issue for NATO going forward. And I do think that a new president would be able to build more trust between the U.S. and allies in responding to the Chinese. But we shouldn't underestimate just how deeply structural these challenges are. Here's where coronavirus does matter, though, because the Chinese have also lost an awful lot of trust in their ability to work constructively inside their country and be the factory of the world with lots of companies around the world. And that's not just the United States. That's also the Europeans. So I think a new president, if they want to be constructive, the back of coronavirus could be an interesting place to start.
There's an appropriate question one of our listeners named Deborah puts forward here. By quarantining millions, she says, China appears to be getting a handle on coronavirus. The U.S. quickly put a travel ban on China travelers. Why isn't the U.S. placing a travel ban on South Korea, Italy, et cetera? Is it because of the economy?
I think in part it's because we feel like we have a lot better data coming out of South Korea and Italy, and that those countries have a much better handle on the people that are and aren't traveling themselves and who's being quarantined, which we
didn't. Excuse me, but at first you said the data, and many people have pointed this out, wasn't coming out of China. Now it's kind of overly coming out in many ways, isn't it, because of Beijing's anger at how things didn't go or should have gone?
Well, again, in the early days, China really mishandled this, right? I mean, from December through January.
Dreadful.
And Xi Jinping had to backtrack, and they had to actually release a speech that he gave.
So I'll use your word. They've overcorrected now?
Whether they've overcorrected, they've certainly overcorrected insofar as it's had a really big impact on the Chinese economy. It was probably the right thing to do, both in terms of political stability for China and also reducing panic globally. It did provide for more weeks of preparedness possibility for the Americans and others. And, you know, we squandered that time, in my view. But still, I think that the 70 million people put under quarantine by the Chinese, given how badly they mishandled the early weeks of the crisis, was probably the right thing for a country like China, a government like Xi Jinping's, to do. Now, the issue is that if they suddenly restart the economy quickly, if they try to have a V-type recovery, given how much asymptomatic transmission there is of coronavirus, the potential that China will have further breakouts is real. So I think they won't do that. I think they'll actually be slower in restarting the economy than the markets have expected. And the impact on the Chinese economy in the second quarter and the third quarter from coronavirus will not be a V recovery. It'll actually take a lot longer to get these guys back online. That's my view.
Our guest is Ian Bremmer. Our next caller is Decker. Decker, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. Comment, any Democrat will need to bring in somebody like retired General Wesley Clark for any of the military advisement for how the world has been screwed up under Trump. Question, if coronavirus were to take out a third world country's government, could the Trump administration step in? If not the Trump administration, who could step in that scenario?
Yeah. You mean like a humanitarian crisis? We're back to that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, if the Americans didn't, the likelihood you would get a coordinated international response would not be there. So you look at we have something like this right now. We have 1 million people on the ground, Syrians fleeing Idlib, and they're heading across the Turkish border and they're heading towards Europe. And the Americans have said, not our problem. And even though it is Europe's problem, they have shown virtually no capacity to respond. Some humanitarian aid, but dreadfully inadequate. So you have the United Nations, you've got the World Health Organization, you've got the International Crisis Group, my friend David Miliband, who I talk to a lot. You've got other folks, but nothing close to what you would need. And I think the response in other developing countries to a coronavirus meltdown as opposed to a refugee meltdown, I expect would be similar.
Well, a good question here from a listener who tweeted, listener named JD. Other than the unfortunate deaths that will follow the spread of coronavirus in the global south, what economic effects do you foresee for impoverished nations?
Well, when you have more isolated economies from each other, certainly that really makes it hard for basic trade to be conducted. And you get hoarding, you get panic buying. People in developing, in the poorest countries, the people that are politically connected are the ones that get the services, are the ones that get the goods, and the people that don't have that access really get hurt. We saw the cholera epidemic in Yemen. We shouldn't have cholera anywhere in the world, but they have none of the infrastructure, none of the governance. And so obviously in a coronavirus environment where the global economy is softening and where investment will be towards safe havens like the United States and developed countries in the world and even places like gold, then the riskier investments aren't going to see the capital. They'll have a hard time engaging in fiscal expansion. They won't be able to raise debt. So, you know, like so many things in the world, when disaster hits, it's the folks that are the least capable that are taking the biggest punishment.
Talking with Ian Bremmer, who is president of the Eurasia Group, and Lottie writes, economic globalism doesn't work. The key word is profit. The type of globalism that's being talked about only benefits corporations who want to set up businesses in other countries because they have fewer environmental and labor regulations.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth to that. And there's also just truth to the fact that it's so short term, that it's so driven by shareholder returns. Just in the same way that NATO doesn't work as well as an organization because the geopolitical balance of the world has shifted towards Asia, but NATO focuses mostly on Russia, so too capitalism doesn't work as well as an institution because labor doesn't matter as much to capital as it used to with automation and robotics and AI. You have far more people in the gig economy working short-time engagements than having permanent long-term employment prospects. And yet the social contract that governments have to provide for their citizens hasn't shifted to reflect the way that capitalism has changed. And so, you know, pretty obviously, the institutions aren't going to function as well. They're going to be seen as delegitimized. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Let me bring another caller aboard. Sanjay joins us. Good morning.
Hi. I had a comment on the question that was asked about why is Trump being supported by, say, how do other leaders react to him? And Modi was used an example and was quoted, Modi is autocratic and therefore he likes Trump. And I think you guys are missing the larger picture there. U.S. has always had a poor relationship with India. They've always supported China for a long time and partly caused by Nehru's non-aligned movement of pretending to be or wanting to be neutral. And this is the first president who's actually willing to work with India, give it arms instead of giving it to Pakistan. And I think Modi is just a very shrewd politician who says, look, this guy's ego is boosted by having 100,000 people show up at a rally. That's what he wants. And India gets a strategic partnership with the U.S., so be it. I don't think it has got anything to be autocratic here. It is just that he's a shrewd politician. He's looking after his country's interest. And he's stroking Trump's ego if it favors a better relationship with India.
I think the point is well taken, Sanjay. I thank you for it. It is a good point. But at the same time, you've written a lot about India's new citizenship law and actually, Modi is building detention centers, which are housing mainly Muslims.
Well, that's the other side, right? I mean, he didn't mention the fact that Modi, who came out as a strong economic reformer, his economy has been slipping dramatically, and he's moved more towards Hindu nationalism, including the bombs into Pakistan, which helped him win a resounding election last year. Now, that has made support for India more divisive in the United States, and the Democrats have been very critical of India, and they've called even for sanctions against India, despite the geopolitical reality that the U.S. and the Indians have greater concern with China. Trump doesn't care at all about that. While Trump was visiting Modi in Delhi and there were big demonstrations and riots and people getting killed, Trump was asked about religious freedom in India and he didn't talk at all about it. He just, you know, basically applauded Modi. So it's not because Modi's an authoritarian. I don't believe Modi is an authoritarian. It's a deeply decentralized democratic system. He has some strongman leanings. That's a different story. But I do think that Sanjay is completely right Pakistan's not getting aid from the United States anymore. Overwhelmingly, their support's coming from China. And when Rex Tillerson, that briefly ill-fated Secretary of State in the United States, but he did come up with the idea of the Indo-Pacific. And that was part of a strategy to bring India away from non-aligned status and towards a U.S. alliance of would-be democracies against China. And there are clearly many people inside India that are deeply happy that the Americans are willing to do that. Let's keep in mind, final point, when Trump went to India, no move on a trade deal because Modi's less interested in economic liberalization, but they did sign a $3 billion new defense deal. And actually,
that's mainly military arms sales. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. But the point is that the strongest part of the U.S.-India relationship right now is the security relationship. That is true. That is also true in countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
There's a listener who writes, I'm very sorry for the people who are sick and suffering, but jobs and manufacturing both should come back to the United States. Not only the U.S., but other Western countries could use jobs coming back to their countries.
Absolutely. I mean, I understand that. Again, you can't blame people. The average American has seen their life expectancy actually decrease in the last 20 years. We all know about opioid addiction. We all know about poor public education as we go down in the global roster. We know about the lack of infrastructure in rural areas and in poorer areas of the United States. And you cannot expect the average American suffering under those conditions who no longer believes in the American dream to support the same kind of American generosity to other countries around the world that we have been providing for generations and generations. It saddens me deeply to say that as someone that can almost see the Statue of Liberty from out my window in the morning because it doesn't reflect who we used to be, doesn't reflect my grandmother coming here into Ellis Island, but I get it. And it's just, it's wrong for American politicians to show no empathy to the need to respond to comments, legitimate comments like that of your listener that's writing in.
Here's Alberto, who says, if Trump were to lose the 2020 election to a Democrat, where would the next president stand with North Korea? Is there anything in writing that was signed by Trump that the next president could build upon? In your opinion, did Trump improve anything as it pertains to North Korea, or did he worsen things?
Well, I mean, a lot of presidents have failed in North Korea. Trump's not the only one. The North Koreans just did test a couple new short-range missiles on Monday. They had suspended we suspended military operations. They suspended some of theirs.
But Trump made himself think, and maybe he got Pompeo to think in this way as well, that somehow you could turn North Korea into what was done with Libya. In other words, they would somehow denuclearize and abandon their nuclear weapons if he just talked about a love affair and how he's going to develop things economically there. That's a failure.
Well, Trump actually, his red line was actually about the development of ICBMs. He wanted the North Koreans to accept denuclearization as a target. But I don't think that there were many people that thought that North Korea was actually going to denuclearize. I mean, let's remember, Saddam Hussein, no nukes, dead. Gaddafi, no nukes, dead. Kim Jong-un, nukes, not dead, right? I mean, these leaders understand when they're rogues and they're poor that having nuclear capacity is a way to ensure your stability and to also blackmail other countries into providing you support. And if the Iranians could figure out a way to get from no nukes to nukes without endangering their regime, and with the Israelis with 100 nukes next to them that are more than willing to blow them up if they start developing, they would clearly get there in the drop of a hat. They just don't know how. But the North Koreans are already there. And so, I mean, you know, to blame Trump, you could say that he provided legitimization to Kim Jong-un in the way that he approached it with the summits and with talking about the love letters. But in reality, U.S.-North Korea relations haven't moved all that much. It's not like Trump didn't take sanctions off of North Korea. I mean,
actually, Trump hasn't taken sanctions off Russia, which is a surprise to many people, given the fact that his relationship with Putin seems to be a kind of love affair, too.
That's absolutely right. And as Trump has said, he did ultimately provide these anti-tank Javelin missiles to the Ukrainians that the Obama administration was unwilling to provide. Now, in the case of Russia,
Trump has internally tried to move away from sanctions. He's gotten massive pushback from everyone in his administration. So that has more to do with the limitations of presidential power and the deep bureaucracy in the U.S. than it does Trump's orientation. But in the case of North Korea, he was willing to talk. He wanted to see if he could get a deal. But until the North Koreans actually provided something, the Trump administration wasn't really doing anything for North Korea.
Yeah, we started off earlier talking about the World Bank issuing this huge amount of money. A listener wants to know, who's issuing funding to help emerging economies fight climate change?
Well, right now the answer is not much. And let's keep in mind, the only way that emerging markets are going to be able to fight climate change effectively is if we as the developed world recognize that carbon emissions are historic. We've been emitting carbon that has caused the problems we have now for generations. The developing world has not. And any deal that we're going to have with China, with India, with sub-Saharan Africa is going to have to recognize total carbon footprint over the course of history. Like Microsoft is saying by 2050, they will be carbon negative for the entire history of Microsoft by 2050. That's the way in. But let's keep in mind that whether you're talking about AOC or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, the Green New Deal, they're not talking about a Green Marshall Plan. They're not talking about, you know, we need to bail out the Chinese for that lack of equity. We're talking about the United States of America. And that's not going to get us. Just like on coronavirus, climate does not respect borders.
Ian Bremmer, always good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us. And Ian Bremmer again. You can hear G-Zero World with Ian Bremmer. It airs Thursdays at midnight on KQED+. And if you're looking for all the results from your local ballot, we got them. KQED has the latest updated results for all local races at kqed.org/elections. Make that slash elections. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.